two or more races. And historically, it was just under 40 years ago that there were laws that prohibited interracial marriage. The Loving versus Virginia case is a landmark civil rights decision of the United States Supreme Court that overturned those laws. So back in August of 2016, I hosted a Thursday night talk. It was Black Male in Humboldt. So my guests were Black men in this community, and they talked about what it was like to be Black in this community. We had a caller call in by the name of Jamie from Arcata, and that conversation kind of flipped from him being a caller, and he became like an additional guest of the show. So we're going to start the show with a clip of Jamie talking about his granddaughter and the treatment that his granddaughter received in preschool.
My granddaughter's father is Black, and you know, in the little preschool here, she was the only Black kid, and she complained because some of the girls were calling her a skunk. And the headmistress could not believe that that had anything to do with race. But my kid was the only one being called a skunk by these little white girls. So I don't know. Maybe I was wrong.
And after that, one of my guests, Kirby Moss, he's a professor here at Humboldt State, he further continued the conversation, and he asked Jamie a question about how he deals with her treatment. So let's listen to that clip.
Deal with her Blackness, and when people say that about her, how does that make you feel?
Well, my impulse is to defend her.
Okay, yeah.
Whether I'm right or wrong, and yeah. No matter what the topic is, because she's my kid.
Yeah.
But also there's a constant sort of inquiry going on. Every time something bad happens to her, somewhere in my mind I go, is it because she's Black? Or is it just because that person is a jerk?
So
I don't know how to put my finger on that unless somebody is actually overtly racial with their verbal assault or their insult or whatever it is.
It could be both, in all
yeah.
truth. Yeah.
So my guest tonight are including attorney Jamie Flower. He was that caller who became an additional guest on that show. He's a local attorney and grandfather of a biracial child. Via Skype, Dr. Gregory Caneas. He teaches in a doctoral program in applied clinical psychology, and he is a multiracial man. Geneva Papars, she is a Humboldt State University student. She's also an assignment editor, news assignment editor for a local news outfit here in Eureka. And she's also a KHSU intern, and she identifies as a biracial woman. And also with me, Michelle Showers. She is a sociology lecturer and the parent of three biracial children, including one of them today. Little Margot is here with us, her youngest daughter of 3 months, I believe. And we'll identify her as Max for the show. So welcome to you all.
Hi, Lorna.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So let's start with you, Jamie. We had this conversation or this show about being Black in Humboldt County, and the focus turned to you. There was another clip that I will play. It was, how do you view race now versus before you had an African-American and white granddaughter? And we're going to bounce off of that clip after it plays and start the discussion.
I had it in a more abstract way. I was really lucky to be born into a household, a family that had a lot of friends of all different colors and sexual orientations, and that's, you know, artists and all kinds of people. And, you know, my mom had Black male friends after she got divorced from my dad. So, you know, I'm lucky that I had the right kind of upbringing in that regard. But yeah, it was more abstract. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And probably without the experience of the family, it would not have become so deeply ingrained in me to kind of go, okay, let's examine this situation.
Right.
And not be knee-jerk, you know, a fearful white guy, or knee-jerk, hey, how come you're being mean to my black granddaughter? You know, that's knee-jerk too.
So, Jamie, how does it feel to be the grandfather of an African-American child?
You know, when I first held her in my arms, I fell in love with her. She could have been purple.
Okay.
But it's really hard to figure out how to teach her when I don't have direct experience myself. Mm. She's 22 now. She's got all the teaching from me she's ever going to get.
Okay.
But when she was a little girl especially, I really didn't know how to handle things. When she was two, this little white boy came up to her on the playground and, oh, can I say this word, or are we saying the N-word?
Let's say the N-word.
Okay. Yeah. Called her the N-word. She didn't have any idea what it was. She asked me what it was. It was a difficult thing to explain. I don't really remember how I did explain it, probably because it was a lot of ers and uhs and then diverting her attention somewhere.
Does she still live in this community?
She's been in L.A. for the last 5 years.
Okay.
She went to UCLA and she graduated last June. She's got a job down there.
Okay.
And I tried to get her to call in tonight, but she's off. Her boyfriend's visiting and she's off somewhere else. But she's related to me some fairly scary things about UCLA, about there being a black party on one side, a white party on the other side, and the police showing up and busting the black party, that kind of thing.
I recall that incident occurring a couple of years ago, and it made national news. Was she at either of those parties?
Not that particular one, but she said that was not rare, that you could kind of expect to have your party broken up sooner if you were playing rap music no louder than the white kids across the way, who were ironically enough probably playing rap music too. she felt like there was kind of a pervasive racism at the school, kind of institutionalized. And see, I don't know myself, but I know she's got pretty good judgment.
Okay.
And so it hurts me every time I hear it. I'm afraid that she's not going to get a fair shake just because of that.
Right. So, Geneva. So, why don't you describe your experience growing up, who you are, what your makeup is?
Okay, so my dad's black and my mom's Mexican. And even that alone, they're both extremely mixed, but that's the easiest way to describe them. And I think it was maybe in first grade. It's early elementary, and I remember my dad sitting down and, you know, asking me, like, what are you? And I remember saying, I'm black. And, you know, and he'd ask, like, what am I? I said, you're black too. And what's your mom? And my mom's very, very fair skinned. And I was like, she's white. And he was like, well, wouldn't that make you white too? And I was like, no. And that was the first conversation they had with me, of like the idea of being two identities and it's not just skin tone. And so that always stuck with me. And my mom always bought black Barbies for me. Our nativity set was black. The angel looked like me on the tree. That was something that growing up, my mom was really strong with the things in the house I identified with. And I think that I didn't really appreciate that until I grew up. And now looking back at that, I have a strong identity of who I am. But I was also raised by my grandma, my Mexican side. And all of my Mexican family members are mixed, half Mexican, half something else. So I felt like I grew up multicultural. I wouldn't say I was multiracial myself, but I definitely feel I grew up multicultural in that regard.
Okay. Now, Michelle, you are an African-American woman, or do you identify with something other than African-American?
Well, for political purposes, I identify as being black.
Okay.
So that's how I identify myself. My oldest is trying to get me to start using the term African American, but I've explained to him why I use the term black as opposed to African American.
Okay.
So that's where we're trying to navigate through those terms right now.
Okay. And you have three biracial children?
I do. I have three biracial children. They're half black and half white. My oldest is 15. My middle child is 7, and Margot is 3 months, and they are all different shades of blackness. Daniel, most people, when they see him, he appears to them as being either Middle Eastern or Hispanic, so they don't automatically assume that he's half black, half white. Aza looks very much, he is very much a little brown boy. And Margot, right now, she appears to most people as being a white baby. That's what she is called by most people. So she shocked a few people before when they looked at the, tried to peek at the baby, and then they see her, and she's not what they assumed she would be. And she's taken some people aback a bit. So we've had some interesting conversations with my middle son, who also is autistic. His idea and his concepts when it comes to race and color, he's very literal. We've tried to express to him, you know, get him to understand that we're black, because I teach my children that they're black because that is what society will teach them very quickly. And I don't want them to be disillusioned into thinking that there's safeness in identifying with whiteness, because even though they're half white, that is not how they're going to be viewed. And my job is to make sure that they're safe and they're aware of themselves and the world. So for him, he sees himself as being brown because he is brown. And when I've talked to him about what his dad is, I'm like, well, your dad is white. And he's very frank. And he's like, no, my dad is pink. So it's just an interesting perspective. And we're trying to, you know, figure out how to get him to understand that, and also to make sure that he understands how the world will view him in many different levels, and to make sure that he's safe as well.
Well, I'm going to come back to you in a moment with a follow-up question, but I'd like to give Dr. Gregory Caneas an opportunity to describe who you are.
Okay. I am African-American Filipino with a Spanish last name. And so that has probably been more of my experience. It has to do with skin color and how people see me based on skin color. So I travel a lot, and when I go to the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico or Spain, people think that I'm Spanish because I fit in the color scheme and have a Spanish last name, and so they'll speak Spanish to me. They will try to, you know, get me involved in that way, and are surprised when I don't speak Spanish. Sometimes they're angry, actually. I've had people say to me, you know, with this Spanish last name, you don't speak Spanish? I'm like, well, no, I'm African-American and Filipino. And then they'll kind of let out. In Haiti, people think I'm European. I visited South Africa this past summer and went with colleagues, 11 students and one colleague who were African-American. And of course, they got the welcome home. No one said that to me because I think they thought I was an Afrikaner. So mine has had to do, I think, more with skin color and that kind of discrimination.
Now, full disclosure, Dr. Caneas and I have known each other almost 40 years, which is hard to believe because neither of us are old enough to. That's our long time. We've known each other since the 7th grade. So I can attest to some of the stories of his treatment. Actually, I have a 26-year-old son, and it's amazing when blacks have children, our children will span the entire color spectrum. So when my son was born, he was very, very red. And when he was a baby, Dr. Caneas and I would hang out quite a bit, and everyone thought he was his child, not mine. So, yeah, people usually identify race or culture to the color of your skin, and mm-hmm. that's not always the case.
Exactly.
So, Michelle, you mentioned that you tell your children that they are black. How does their white father respond to you telling them that and not including part of him in that?
He actually, we haven't had the discussion, I'll say lately. When Aza was much younger, when he was around one, I would try to talk to his dad about how the world's going to see Aza and to make him aware of that and to prepare him so he could prepare Aza. But he always insisted that Aza would not have any issues because he's half white and that it would never be a problem. And for me, it was a huge problem because him being naive could be something that would come back to harm Aza in the long run.
Absolutely.
Because if he's not learning these lessons at home, then he will be learning lessons when he goes out away from us. So for his dad to not accept the fact that his son will be treated differently and treated as other, it was a big problem. And it's still a big issue because it's not something that he ever discusses with him.
So has he faced issues such as Jamie and his granddaughter being called the N-word, or have your children faced that?
Daniel has never had those issues, and I ask him all the time. He goes to a local high school, and we've had these discussions since he was very young, but he's never had any issues, and I think it is because he doesn't present as being half black and half white. So people just put him in that safe category of other,
mm-hmm.
very ambiguous. And Aza hasn't mentioned anything. We've had some discussions, but he's never mentioned that anyone has called him by using any kind of racial slurs or any inappropriate language.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant. If you'd like to join in the conversation, feel free to call 707-826-4805. Our toll-free number is 800-640-5911. And you can also text your question to 707-492-KHSU. And that's 492-5478. Now, Dr. Kanias, back to you. And incidentally, he is joining us via Skype from Southern California. Now, you teach clinical psychology, applied clinical psychology. In your teaching, does the discussion of multiracial existence come up ever? And how do you tackle that?
You said multiracial. Can you give that to me again?
In your teaching, are there discussions about growing up or being multiracial in society on a clinical psychological level?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the classes that I'm teaching this semester is diversity and other special populations. And so, yeah, it comes up frequently as we're talking about mixed race families, in some cases blended families, you know, just how to do things so that children grow up respecting both cultures if they're multiracial, all of what makes them whole. So it does come up quite frequently. And people will talk about experiences that they've had, a lot of them related to, like, skin color, how they were treated within their family, if they are maybe the only biracial or multiracial person in the extended family, how they're treated in the community. So it comes up quite frequently with students and then with clients as well in clinical sessions.
So that brings me to a question for Geneva. Here at Humboldt State, annually, we have cultural graduations. In addition to the regular unified commencement ceremonies, there are cultural graduations. There's Black grad, there's Asian Desi, Asian Pacific grad, there's queer grad, there's Latino grad. A lot of students identify as Mexican or Black. And historically, Black graduation and Latino graduation fall on the same day at the same time.
Very true.
Tell me about your experience with that and how it made you feel.
So I'm the first in my family to go to college, and I walked last semester, and was super excited to have my whole family come up here. And I wasn't going to do a cultural grad, but it was really important to my grandma. And so I signed up for them both because, you know, when I came to college is when I stopped identifying as half Black, half Mexican, because just to me, I feel like that was internalizing the idea of, like, you're divided and, you know, it's like I'm Black and Mexican, I'm not half, you know, just to add fractions seems to me crazy. And so I signed up for them both, took pictures for them both, was ready to go to them both, and I was raised by my Mexican family, and so that was the family that was coming up here to see me graduate. My dad's older and wasn't able to come up here, and so I had to choose which graduation I was going to go to. And knowing that they're both at the same time, and my grandma was the one that was in the stands watching me walk, and so I felt torn of, like, well, even if my friends are doing this one, and, you know, Black grad, and I'm going to have my Mexican family sit in the stands, and knowing that they're not going to see a traditional Latino cultural graduation. And that was something that I felt like my whole life, the star testing on the back. I used to get in trouble for bubbling both marks, and they used to throw my test away and having to do it all over again, because you can't do that. You can't identify as both. And even with jobs and in as an adult woman, when I fill out tax information, they always send it back to me because I can't. It's either Mexican, Black, or two or more races. There's no way you could be both. And so, yeah, that was hard for me to choose to go to Latino grad, knowing that, you know, it just felt like my whole life I've had to make a choice during different situations on what I'm going to represent myself as. And to have it in my face at cultural grad was something that, like, it really brought it to my attention of, like, you know, you really can't escape it. And yeah, that was, it's difficult for me.
And you're probably the youngest one at the table here today. And what I've learned, you know, growing up, I had friends who identified as half something, half something else. But now your generation is moving away from that, I'm learning. You don't want to place the labels on who you are, or force yourself to make a selection or a choice of one thing or the other. Have you experienced that with other friends, or have you had those discussions?
I definitely think by identifying as, the reason why I stopped saying half was because it felt like, I mean, growing up, I always felt like I wasn't Black enough to be Black and never Mexican enough to be Mexican. And so by saying half and half, it was like alienating myself of, like, I'm not neither. I'm this category of this separate category. And inside me, I was raised with Mexican traditions, but I am a Black woman, and I was raised with my Black father, and my dad was born in 46, so there's a big generation gap between us. And my dad grew up in Hunters Point, and when the 60s, he was 20, he had a lot of friends that were part of the Black Power movement and things like that. And so growing up, the things that he would tell me kind of setting me up for how society sees me. And I used to always think, like, my dad's so disillusioned. It must be because he's so old. Like, that's not the way the world is anymore. And then I moved out on my own, and I moved out to Humboldt County, and I've realized that it's not everyone thinks the same ways. And so for me, one way that I can take back my identity was by identifying not as half or not as part, you know, because I am both. And I've come to the terms that when I have my kids, regardless of what race is, if they add more onto there, they are not going to be part this, part that, but definitely just identify.
Jamie, what about your granddaughter? Does she say she's Black? Does she say she's white? How does she identify?
If she has to check a box, she'll put Black or African American or whatever the box happens to say. And I think that's because of what Michelle was saying, that there's a certain reality out there, and maybe it shouldn't be that way, but it is. She went from being the only black kid most of the time to having a whole black circle of friends in L.A., with them teasing her about how light-skinned she was. In a very friendly way, though. I mean, I got worried about it because I've heard of this kind of problem, but they just think it's funny.
Yeah, and so sometimes it isn't, especially when you're called skunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that she really also is unconscious when she's just living her life and nobody's challenging her or asking her any questions. I think she's pretty much unconscious of race until it comes up somehow, whether it's filling out the form or somebody confronting her. My favorite story about her is that she was at McKinleyville High for a while, and there was a girl at McKinleyville High who, for some reason, conceived an enmity for Alana. And Alana heard that this girl was going around the school saying, "I'm going to beat that NB's ass." And Alana found herself passing this girl in the hallway at lunchtime one day. And so she asked the girl, "Have you been going around calling me an N?" And the girl said, "Yeah, what are you going to do about it?" And Alana punched her right in the face and knocked her flat. I'm not a violent guy normally, but that really seemed like kind of an appropriate reaction to me. And I was actually very pleased with the staff there because they understood that. I mean, Alana definitely got the lecture. We don't solve our problems by violence. But the undercurrent was, we understand. We understand, you know? I mean, it's an emotional thing to have somebody attack you that way.
If I may quote the illustrious Tupac, he has a song where he says, "I ain't no killer, but don't test me."
Yeah.
And that was
exactly
quite the situation. So, Dr. Caneas.
Yes.
How have you experienced your... let's talk about your experiences as a multiracial man. How do you navigate through life just day to day? And how do you identify?
So I identify African-American and Filipino now. But growing up, I just identified as African-American. I think because I got so much flack about it. I also come from a family that's largely African-American. Only my paternal grandfather was Filipino. So he had a sister, but she didn't immigrate to the U.S., and so we never grew up knowing her or, you know, a large extended family, whereas my mom is African-American. Her extended family is, of course, African-American, as well as my father's. Most of his family was. So I think in some ways it was a little bit easier for me because we were so influenced by that. It was later that I embraced the Filipino part. You know, after going to college and understanding how important that was to honor both sides.
So do you mind if I share a story about calling you up when I saw your dad on the local news in Los Angeles?
No, go ahead.
So, do you remember that?
Vaguely.
So I can't remember the story, but Dr. Canese's father was a CPA, and I think the story was about being multiracial. And And I was watching the local news after school. I think we were in high school, and your dad said, "Well, I'm French and I'm Spanish and I'm this," and I called you up and said, "I didn't know." And if I remember correctly, your response was, "I didn't know either." Do you recall that?
I do.
So what was your father's total makeup culturally or racially?
My father's mother was African-American, although, as I understand it, she was also part white. But she never, my grandmother passed away when I was, I think, 17, and we had conversations, but that never came up. So I never knew that. And then, of course, his dad was Filipino, so he spoke about that. I think he mentioned that he was black, he was European-American, and that he was Filipino. And so, yes, when you saw that interview, I remember you calling me, and I was like, what? Where did that come from? I think my father struggled with it a little bit more than I did. And so I think that's one of the reasons why when I was in the doctoral program, I chose to write on racial identity, because I remember things coming up for him, because he was actually half, probably, and whereas I was a quarter. So I think that was his way of acknowledging all parts of himself. It was just that that was not something that I knew about, and you brought it to my attention. I actually thought you were going to tell the Zoot Suit story.
Well, why don't you share that?
So, in college, we watched the film Zoot Suit. I'm not sure if the other panelists are familiar with that, but it's about Latinos in L.A. in, like, the 40s, and they wear a certain type of suit, and it's about their culture. So we watched that, and at the end of the film, a professor turns to me and says, tell us about the Zoot Suit and your culture. Like, that's not my culture. Thank you for putting me on the spot. And that's not my culture. So it was kind of funny, but that again goes back to what I said earlier about people wanting to categorize us, and based on your look, your skin color, your last name, wanting to place you where they feel most comfortable. So I've had a lot of experiences like that.
You know, my mother's last name was McCone. She was never, ever confused for an Irish woman. So I guess the Spanish name, that plays a role.
Yeah, a big role for me.
Yes, and it has been the source of a lot of great stories over the years. So one thing that I have encountered living here in Humboldt County, I've been here since 2007. The population makeup is probably 2 to 3% African American or black. The percentage of mixed race or multiracial children is overwhelming. So if you go into the schools, you won't see a lot of black children, but you will see quite a few caramel children. That's the best way to describe them, caramel children. And I have a biracial granddaughter, and I never really thought about biraciality or living biracial until she was born 4 years ago. And Geneva, you mentioned, you know, growing up, you always got black Barbies. My granddaughter is 4, and she will say, you know, Daddy, your skin is brown, and Mommy, your skin is caramel, or I can't remember exactly how she identifies, but she will say, I'm black, and I'm Lao. So she recognizes both. I took her to the store a couple of days ago, and she wanted a Barbie doll. And there were varying colors. And she picked one and didn't say anything about it and grabbed it. And when my son saw the doll, he asked, did you tell her to pick the black doll? And I said, nope. I just watched and observed, and she did it on her own. So growing up, Geneva, how difficult, or what were the difficulties you faced with Latinas, with black girls in school, and who did you date in school? Because that seems to be a big issue, especially in high school, and wanting to belong and being in the right group. So how did you navigate that?
Honestly, for me, it was the hardest part was elementary and middle school. Yeah. High school, by that time, maybe it's because I had moved, but growing up, I've always lived in a rural area. I grew up in Sonoma County, and when I grew up in Sonoma, I went to elementary school there, Head Start. Most of my classmates were identified as Latino. Most of them spoke Spanish. The other half were white, and I was probably the only Black person. Maybe each grade probably had one Black person, if that, at my school. And I remember just not really fitting in with the Latino, because I couldn't speak Spanish, and that was a big thing, was that I didn't grow up speaking Spanish. And so I just remember in elementary school not really feeling like I belonged, and I had a few friends, but at every recess I just felt perplexed. I felt I had really bad anxiety. My stomach would hurt. It was just always something that was a big deal for me, because I never knew where to sit or who to sit with. Then when my mom passed away when I was in fifth grade, so I moved to my grandma's house, and my grandma lives in a predominantly white community, and when I started the fifth grade, I remember it was only 3 weeks into school, and we were learning about, I can't even remember, and I remember some girl turning to me and telling me that I was Black, and therefore I had no rights, and that was like my first, and I didn't have my dad there, and so this was like my first time, like, this is what my dad was preparing me for. And it wasn't until that moment that I kind of reflected on how I grew up, because I didn't have the Black dolls at that point. And I didn't have my parents at my side to kind of explain it to me. And so, yeah, and I made Black friends at that school. And then in high school, it just kind of, race was something that was so, didn't really think about it as much. And I feel like racial comments and racial slurs weren't really made at my high school, at least towards me, and I don't want to take away from anybody else. So I feel like for me, it was getting through elementary and middle school and then realizing who I was and taking that to high school. But after that, I haven't really had any problems. It was mostly kids. Kids could be cruel.
Absolutely. Michelle, you have two children who are currently in school, but you lived in the South for a while. Was it Mississippi or Alabama?
Alabama. I'm from Alabama, and I've lived there pretty much my whole life. So I'd say about 34 out of 39 years I've lived in Alabama. But I'm from the larger city. I'm from Mobile, the birthplace of Mardi Gras. Have to give a plug. Yes, not New Orleans.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Okay.
So, I've always been aware of race, of course, being from Alabama, but I've never been made aware of my race so much as I am constantly living here in Humboldt County.
Mm. I can see that. Mm-hmm. I lived in the South for a short time, and I tell people all the time, even living in the South, I've never felt so protected of my race and my racial identity as I have in California, mm-hmm. especially Humboldt County. I've been called the N-word so many times right here in this community, and sometimes it's painful. If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. We're talking about living and being multiracial. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the numbers to call are 707-826-4805, 800-640-5911, or you can text your question to 707-492-KHSU, or that's 492-5478. So, as the grandmother of a biracial grandchild, like I said, I've never been so protective of race and identity until that little girl came along. And like you, Jamie, I didn't really notice it until a trip to San Francisco, and we went to Chinatown, and to watch people look at my granddaughter, Asian people, look at her with a little bit of disdain, and it kind of hurt me. Mm-hmm. Did you experience that in times when you and your granddaughter were together?
You know, I can't remember a time that we've been out in the world together and there was anything like that going on. She's had, most of her experiences have been when I was not there on the playground, and she had to come back and tell me about it, and punching the girl in the face, that kind of stuff. But when we've been out in the world, we've usually just had a really good time and nobody's bothered us. And I like to think that that's just kind of the vibe, that we've got this vibe where we're together and we love each other and we're having a good time and everybody else knows that. It's a little naive, but it's worked pretty well so far, with a few exceptions.
So let's bring this conversation to right now, 2017, in this current climate, if you will. According to research by PolicyLink, their National Equity Atlas, they say that diversity is increasing. America is becoming a true world nation that is increasingly multiracial and multicultural. In 1980, 80% of the population was white. By the year 2044, the majority of Americans are projected to be people of color. If you look at the statistics, the population of white Americans are decreasing, not having as many children because of the influx of immigration. As of now, we don't know what the future will hold, but at this point, we are a melting pot. So whites are having fewer children. Latinos are having more children. The largest population growth in the nation are Asians. And the mixed race population is actually growing as well. So what do you think about this current climate, living as a multiracial person or raising multiracial children, or you as the white guy in the room? what do you think about that?
I think it's going to be really hard for a while. There's such a backlash going on. After a black president, we should have known we would get something like this. I mean, this is backlash to the max. And who knows how long or how deep it's going to affect us. But it certainly does. I'm more afraid now when my kid's out and around in the world. I hear more anecdotes. Obviously, anecdotes about bigotry in general, whatever the type is that's being gone after, whether it's Jewish or female or whatever, seems like there's a whole bunch of people that see this trend coming of this diversity that we all think, oh good, life will be a lot less boring. But they don't see it that way. They see it as a threat, and they believe it's a threat. They're not just looking for somebody to bash. And I try to keep that in mind, that I feel their fear might be wrong, but I believe it comes from a kind of a sincere place of not knowing what is going to happen to them in the future. And then you get somebody come along like Trump, who just capitalizes on that and says, oh yeah, go get those people. Go get the reporter with the disability or whatever it happens to be at the moment, and sort of gives folks permission to pop off and to act out their fear in a hateful way.
For myself, when it comes to my oldest, when Trump was elected, the day after he went to school, of course, and I let him know that if anyone started anything at school, to come home, to just immediately come home, because the first thing he needs to do is be safe. And I know that there are a lot of people right now who are behaving as though they are drunk, So, you know, drunk man's words or sober man's thoughts.
Hmm.
There's a lot of that going on right now. And for me, it is scary because he's 15 and he's taller than me. And to a lot of people, he's not a child anymore. He's my child, but he's a man, and he's going to be treated as thus. And it's always kind of ironic to me driving around the area when I see people with Confederate flags on their vehicles, and me being from the actual South, you know, I'm kind of, you know, wondering what's it all about. Now, of course, I know what it is all about, but it's a scary time. It's a scary time for me to be raising a young Black man, as well as having a child with a disability, and being really concerned about what's going to happen with services, and knowing that, you know, the way that everything works, it's really hard to get children who are of color diagnosed for certain things and to get services for them as well. So we have a lot of battles coming ahead of us, just on a personal level, as a family and a community. And it is scary, but out of scary, dark times comes a lot of positive growth. And we've gotten through a lot worse, so we can get through this too.
As a matter of fact, that was a text question from Jenny, if wanting to know if any of the children here have been denied access to programs offered in the public school systems.
Mine has not, because
because of you.
Because of me. We were actually fortunate enough. This is our second time living in the area. When Aza was 3, he was diagnosed as being autistic, so we were able to get resources and therapy really quickly and get everything going. And I was a graduate student here at HSU, and I made him my master's project. Mm. Because I just want to be prepared for what is life going to be like for him. What do we do to make it work for him? Because he has to be able to function in a neurotypical world, even though he's not neurotypical. So he's been my life's work. And we haven't had any issues because I've made sure that I know the laws, I know what's required, I know what he's entitled to. And I come to meetings with that knowledge, and people do not mess with me. So we have not had issues, but I do know friends who work in the school system here, and I've heard many stories of children of color being denied services and their parents not being aware of what their rights were.
I have a story about that. When Alana was in the 5th grade, she wanted to apply for the GATE program, the Gifted Kids program.
Mm. Yes.
And the first step in that was her teacher, her homeroom teacher, filling out a form. And her teacher filled the form out just glowingly and said, Alana's obviously gifted. She's obviously eligible for the program. It would do her a lot of good. In my opinion, she's more eligible for it than some of the kids that are in it. Glowing, glowing. So Alana had these tests, and I was told that she had flunked the tests and couldn't be in the GATE program. When I looked into the tests, I found that they were being used as a gatekeeper, which was illegal under the education code. That they were being scored in a very arbitrary kind of a way. And the bad news was, your kid's not gifted, and she can't come to our program. And again, this is one of those incidences. Was there race involved here? I don't know. I do know that her teacher, who filled out the form, was Black. Was the only Black teacher at the school at that time. And she was Black, and there were no Black kids in the GATE program. And it was one of those times. I didn't want to just jump to that conclusion. And on the other hand, there was some circumstantial evidence. So I got my lawyer skills going, and I started to ask questions about why the tests had come out that way. And I started to point out that they weren't really supposed to be using the tests the way they were using them. And the teacher who ran the program at the time was very polite about answering my emails and such, without really ever answering anything, but at least replying. Until I asked this question: I know that who the specific kids in the program is confidential, but would you please tell me what the racial and gender breakdown is of kids in the GATE program in the Eureka City School District? That was the last I ever heard from the GATE program. Again, just a coincidence? Maybe so.
Hmm.
But it kind of stank to me. It kind of stank. It was especially ironic when she said, you know, the kids in the GATE program get African dancing classes. But I can't go.
Sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying. Wow. We have a caller, Alexis from Eureka.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening, Alexis.
Hi.
Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Chef. Hi, Lorna.
So this is a small community, so Michelle and I both know who Alexis is, maybe a few others. So do you have a question, Alexis?
So I don't really have a question. I have a comment. You know, I'm a mixed mom of a very beautiful, little mixed, colorful baby, Jalea, who's 15 months. So my experience is very new to this whole thing. And it's definitely interesting. It's definitely a stupid thought. I don't feel like I've had anything really surprising. Too surprising because I have a family that is very multi-ethnic that I grew up with. So I'm not shocked by a lot of things that happen. But we have had some really interesting things happen, and most of it, of course, has been, actually, I would say half here in Humboldt and half back home on the East Coast where I grew up, Washington, D.C. And I think the most starking thing that ever happened to me, I was in Costco one day, and a older black woman, and this is how she identified herself, I guess saw me come in the store, and I didn't see her, and she just walked up to me and said, "Oh, my gosh. You know, you got everybody in their heads turning in here, coming here with that white man and that little mixed baby." And I said, "Well, glad to hear your opinion, but I really don't care how anyone feels about it." And so I've had a lot of that happen. A lot of people ask me if my baby's Chinese or Asian, which she's not, or we don't identify as that. But, you know, it happens. And I guess it's because of her eyes is what they've told me. So I've had a lot of interesting things happen. And I don't think it's going to be surprising. I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. I don't think it's going to, you know, be any worse than it already is. I think it's just going to be the same. And as we have more and more diverse children and mixed cultures, people will just show their true colors a little bit more, I guess.
No pun intended.
So, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Even if it's unintended or intended, we will see it and hear it a lot more.
Yes, and so, yeah. Knowing you, Alexis, you will be fiercely protective of your daughter in the same manner Michelle is fiercely protective of her children. And, I don't see you facing problems with being denied any services for your daughter because she's mixed or... person of color, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, and I should also preface this with, you know, I work in the local education system here, and my job, not only based in Humboldt County, but also Del Norte, and parts of Trinity County, is to go out and keep our young people knowledgeable about what is available to them after they graduate high school. What access do they have to these things? What can they expect? What type of services and support do they need? And a big piece of what I do is helping my students of color understand what it's like to navigate those systems and how important it is to have support when you're in those systems, because a lot of times they don't get that information. They get, okay, you graduate high school, then you go on to college, good luck. But they forget to tell them that when you get there, there's a whole new set of struggles you have to go through. And one of those big struggles is trying to figure out who you are and come to terms with your own identity. And that changes, as one of your guests said. You know, when she was younger, she identified as black and Mexican. When she went to college, that changed, and she let go of that. And so part of what I do is helping students to understand what support you can get when you go to those schools to help you once you start trying to figure out who you are and help you be successful and make it through. So with me doing that as a career, I know my child will never have those issues, because I know how important it is to be informed and knowledgeable about what's out there and what resources she needs to have access to. And I also know it's really important to know how to be your own advocate and be empowered and feel empowered to go out and be someone who can stand up for yourself, especially when you see things that or hear things that aren't right or wrong. So,
absolutely. Well, thank you for your call and your comments, Alexis.
Thanks for having this. I really appreciate it. You guys have a good night.
Thank you. You too. So we are almost out of time. I'd like to give each of my guests just a few moments for a closing statement, if you will. Let's start with Dr. Gregory Caneas via Skype.
So one of the things I think I would like to share is I'm working with a lot of kids who have dealt with this issue, and then as adults as well, is to really emphasize talking about race and their being biracial when they're young, and helping them to strengthen their racial identity. I think that that can have a really positive impact on kids who are growing up with parents of different races.
Absolutely. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Geneva?
Yeah, I would say definitely just starting the conversation young. And one thing that in hindsight I realized that I don't really know if she knew if that's what she was doing at the time, but for me and my mom, a lot of that was discussed through books, either the books that she provided for me or books we would read together, and that's something that has stuck with me even as an adult. And so that's something I'd recommend, is just conversation and reading as a young, just understanding who you are and what you have to bring to the world, and you know, and sharing that with other people.
Jamie?
Just to get a little off topic, about services and the ability to get them, in a way, the two biggest threats we have right now aren't directly based on race. They're the threats against the healthcare insurance system, and there are the threats against the women's health system. That those apply to all women and all girls everywhere, no matter what their race is. And of course, the poorer they are, the harder it's going to be to get the services. So maybe that's something to think about in terms of a unifier going forward. So sorry to plug Planned Parenthood, but all my girls have gone to Planned Parenthood and gotten wonderful service there, and I'm very grateful to them.
Yes.
So that's my plug.
Yes. And Michelle?
So for me, everything always ties back to education, because education is key. That's how I was raised, and that's how I raise my children. And I think it's really important just to let young children know growing up that you have to know what history says, because history is definitely repeating itself every day, more and more. I've heard. I'm trying to remember our president's direct quote about Frederick Douglass. It was more and more every day, something like that.
Right. He's doing a great job.
Yeah, yes. More and more.
And but people will talk about him more and more, which
and more.
Is true.
Yes, especially
as of
now.
Late. Yes.
So definitely education, because if you don't understand how things that are set up to divide you work, then you won't understand what you can do to overcome those struggles.
Absolutely.
So that's
absolutely.
That's what I always stress.
And I'm just going to end with, no matter what your makeup is, be proud of who you are. No matter what that mix is, be proud of who you are and from where you come. Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank my guest, Geneva Papars, attorney Jamie Flower, Michelle Showers, and to Baby Max, thank you for your comments as well. And via Skype, Dr. Gregory Caneas. Also, thanks to our producer, Geraldine Goldberg, and our engineer, Michael Roccaforte. See you next month. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thank you to our host, Lorna Bryant, and our guests, Geneva Papars, Michelle Showers, Dr. Gregory Caneas, and Jamie Flowers. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on Thursday Night Talk, after last month's Women's March, many have asked themselves, how do I get involved in politics? Is now the right time? How scary can it be? Next on Thursday Night Talk, Brenda Starr and guest Julie Fulkerson discuss where and how do we rise from here. That's February 23rd at 7. Thank you to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next. It's 8 o'clock.
Tune in to the KHSU magazine, KHSU.